This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. The impact of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy is still being felt at the southern border. While the majority of the children that garnered national attention this summer have been reunited with their parents, there's another crisis in the making, a record number of migrant kids in federal custody, most of whom crossed the border alone. The federal government is increasingly relying on makeshift tent cities for these kids. One is in Tornillo, Texas, and one is in Miami-Dade County. And while this is not the first time the federal government has used tent encampments for migrant children, this time around, critics say it's a crisis of the government's own making. Joining me now to discuss this is Bob Moore, an independent journalist based in El Paso, who writes about the border for publications like the Texas Monthly and the Washington Post. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And Mark Greenberg, the former head of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families under President Obama. Mark, thanks for being with the show.
And thanks very much.
So, Bob, let's start with you. The federal government now has more than 12,800 kids in its custody. That's five times as many as last year. How did we get here?
One, to update the stats, it's now well over 13,000, according to numbers I got yesterday. Children have been crossing the border unaccompanied from Central America in large numbers since around 2014. Mark can talk about how the Obama administration dealt with it, but the Trump administration has changed some policies. You have overall sort of this climate out there that makes immigrant families very unlikely to step forward and try to take sponsorship of these children who arrive at the border unaccompanied. And then you had the implementation of very specific policies, particularly a new requirement that any family that wants to sponsor one of these children who arrives at the border without a parent or guardian, which is usually another family member, must now submit their fingerprints to ICE as well as the fingerprints of any adult in the household. Most of these families, of course, have at least one undocumented member in the household, and this has just had a massive chilling effect on the willingness of these families to take these children in. So they're sitting in federal custody, which increasingly means thousands of them are sitting in these temporary facilities in tents, either in the desert here in Texas or out in Homestead, Florida.
Mark, I want to ask, we're being told that this is the highest number of migrant children being held in detention ever. But in 2014, as Bob mentioned, at that point you were with the Obama administration, there were far more unaccompanied children crossing the border. What's the difference between 2014 and today?
So first, that's exactly right, that this is the highest number ever in custody. It is not because this is the highest number of arrivals ever. The number of arrivals is greater this year than it was last year, but it's not nearly as high as it was in 2014 or 2016. So the reason that a much larger number of children are in custody now in the shelters is because when they arrive, they are staying in shelters for longer periods of time, and the rate at which they're being released has slowed dramatically. That's the basic difference.
And you know, as a reminder, again, you oversaw you at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families under the Obama administration, and that's when the first tent cities were used for these kids. Can you tell us, walk us through the decision then to use these?
Sure. We did use military facilities in 2014. They, in various ways, there are some physical differences between what these arrangements look like and what those did. But basically what happened in 2014 is there was a very large, unexpected increase in the number of arriving children. It had been ranging in about 2,000 to 3,000 a month, and then that spring it went up to 6,000, then 9,000, then 10,000. So the numbers were very large. We didn't have adequate shelter capacity for them, and so we turned to the Department of Defense and used Defense Department facilities. They would be known in the jargon as influx facilities, and the reason that we needed to do that is that normally the shelters for the children are state licensed and state regulated. When you have to increase the shelters in a hurry, it's not possible to go through the state licensing process. So that's why we did it, but that's really different than the current situation where, again, it's not because of a sudden anticipated surge. It's because of policies and the enforcement environment.
Bob, I'm curious. The federal government opened this tent encampment in Tornillo, Texas, back in June, and you've visited this camp. Can you tell us what it was like?
At the time I was there, they had 20 housing tents set up and then a number of other tents for a dining hall and healthcare facilities and things like that. But in each of the tents set up to house children, you had 10 sets of bunk beds, so 20 beds in each tent. At the time, it was set up for about 400 people. It has now expanded dramatically and can house up to 3,800 children. The tents are well air-conditioned, which is a good thing. In Texas at that part of the summer, we had temperatures topping out at about 107 at that point in time. So, you know, the children were well taken care of from what I could see, well fed, not being educated. There's no schooling going on there. And at the time, because it was so hot, the children weren't allowed outside after 11 in the morning. Now, those restrictions would have eased a bit because the high temperatures now are in the low 90s and much safer for children. There are both boys and girls housed there. They're housed in separate facilities and do not appear to mingle. And when I was there, which was right after it opened in June, you did have a handful of children who had been forcibly separated from their parents at the border. But for the vast majority of kids who were there then and who are there now, these are the children who arrived at the border without a parent or guardian and then were taken into government custody. In the past, as Mark mentioned, they were able to place children much more quickly. An average of about 30 days during the Obama administration was what kids spent in detention. That number is now up to at least 59 days on average and probably significantly higher now because I think that figure dates to sometime in August. So you have children just staying longer and longer in these facilities. And it's also worth noting those averages do not include kids who just aren't placed with sponsors. So even those numbers are a bit misleading. They're in a shelter for a very, very long time now.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Bob Moore and Mark Greenberg, and we're talking about tent cities being used to house unaccompanied migrant children. Mark, how are these facilities supposed to work exactly? And going off of what Bob was just describing, and I want to bring in a section from a New York Times article that was written about that same facility, Tornillo, Texas. And it said that, you know, the children are sleeping in bunks. There's no school. They're given workbooks that they have no obligation to complete, and access to legal services is limited. And that's, again, from the New York Times. Mark, are these facilities functioning the way they were intended to function?
So the goal should be to not have to use influx facilities. The system normally operates with a set of standard shelters, which, as I had noted, are state licensed, state regulated, provide a range of services to the children, including education and legal services and recreation and mental health and case management and others. So that's the way the system is supposed to work. The problem is that children are spending longer and longer in this shelter system, and the lack of capacity has forced the administration to turn to these influx shelters. The influx shelters are not state-licensed or regulated. They are having to set them up very quickly. For the children in them, the concerns are fundamentally that it is not a good thing for children to be in a mass shelter, and particularly to be in a mass shelter for an extended period of time. It's stressful, it's difficult for mental health, it increases the risks of children acting out, it's hard on staff, and I should also note it is hugely expensive for government. So it's really not, in my view, in anybody's interest to be operating influx shelters for extended periods of time like this.
Bob, we just heard, you know, Mark say that it's expensive for government. I'm wondering, do we know who's making money off of these contracts to house these children? Are there any companies that stand to benefit from this?
There are two contractors currently running these influx shelters. The shelter in Texas is operated by a nonprofit based in San Antonio called BCFS, which is a former faith-based organization called Baptist Children and Family Services. It's still somewhat of a faith-based organization, but not quite what it was before, but it is a nonprofit. The one in Florida is run by a for-profit company called Comprehensive Healthcare Services. These contracts can be quite lucrative and, as Mark mentioned, incredibly expensive for taxpayers. So the government, I'm most familiar with Tornillo, obviously, living right here. The government published a notice in the Federal Register a few weeks ago that it plans to spend up to $368 million operating the Tornillo facility over the last 3.5 months of the year. That's $100 million a month just to operate this one facility. It is incredibly expensive. And so the operator, BCFS, is probably netting somewhere between, you know, $10 and $12 million a month to operate that if they do reach full capacity. So it's a tremendous amount of money for this nonprofit organization.
Mark, does that sound about right to you? And in your experience, is that the best use of taxpayer dollars?
So I can't speak to the per month. What I can say is that the influx shelters were much more expensive than standard shelters, three times as expensive. And that was one of the many reasons why one doesn't want to run influx shelters anytime that you don't absolutely have to.
And Mark, what do you see as the long-term impacts of this?
The biggest concern here is how long children are staying in shelters, that they're not being released to their families. And that has happened because Health and Human Services is increasingly playing the role of a partner in immigration enforcement. And as long as it operates that way, there is a risk that the number of children in shelters is going to keep going up and up.
Bob Moore is an independent reporter who covers the border. Mark Greenberg is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
And we did reach out to HHS for comment and have not heard back yet.
The troops have moved in. It started off as a peaceful demonstration. The army was circling this plaza called the Plaza of the Three Cultures. They were holding a peaceful rally, but now the troops have come and you can hear what it sounds like.
50 years ago, students across Mexico took to the streets in a movement demanding democracy, the liberation of political prisoners, and an end to Mexico's authoritarian government. But on October 2nd, 1968, the Mexican military attacked the students.
The army is here and they're firing. They're letting go with just about everything they have. The other troops have swept across the plaza.
That sound from CBS reporting that as the students gathered at the Three Cultures Plaza for a demonstration in Mexico City, the Mexican government fired on the protesters. The exact number of dead is disputed, but estimates say there were close to 300 killed.
Es bien conocido que
it's well known that the events of October 2nd precipitated the end of the movement in a bloody manner. It was repression that to this day has not been clarified in a sufficient way. But after that, it generated a tradition of consciousness and struggle in the public universities.
Naum Perez Monroy is an adjunct professor at the National Autonomous University of Mexico and a leader in the present-day student movement. He's also an organizer with the University Defense Committee.
The University Defense Committee began in the year 2012, stemming from the Yo Soy 132 student movement. In a country with such social inequality, where public education faces constant attacks, with austerity measures and attacks of privatization, our organization seeks to fight for the youth and the working class.
We asked Naum how the student movement from 1968 and the massacre that took place 50 years ago today are seen by the present-day student movement.
Today, in the present-day movement that has surged in the universities in the central part of the country, we are seeing a new generation that is waking up to the struggle, to social consciousness. And it is also a generation that remembers and knows that to this day there has been no justice, and that those responsible for the massacre have not been brought to justice.
Do To understand more about the massacre and what we've learned about it 50 years later is Kate Doyle. She's a senior analyst at the National Security Archive who's researched U.S. and Mexican government documents regarding the event. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So we are talking about a turning point in Mexican history. Tell us what happened 50 years ago today.
50 years ago, there was a robust student movement that began in the spring of 1968 with students from universities all over the city and eventually all over the country pouring out into the streets and asking, really for the first time, for change, for freedoms, for an end to police and military brutality, for the president of Mexico to step down, for authoritarianism to end. It was an exciting and powerful kind of civic movement that really had no precedent in Mexico. And that movement attracted a lot of anger from the Mexican government. And slowly over the course of the summer and into the fall, as the movement grew in strength and the demands became sharper and more articulated, the government began to crack down. And the crackdown culminated after months of back and forth between the government and the students with the terrible shootout and massacre that took place during a protest meeting in the public square at Tlatelolco in Mexico City on October 2nd, when dozens of students and bystanders were killed and injured.
Who was in power at the time? We mentioned the students were rebelling against the government. What was the government of Mexico at that time, and what was it that the students were trying to get from them?
At that time, the government was the Institutional Revolutionary Party that had taken power after the revolution in Mexico, a little after the turn of the century, and had been in power in decades. And although the PRI, as it was called in its Spanish acronym, although the PRI had been able to deliver over the decades a fairly strong and healthy economy and a comfortable society for some, the students were calling out what they saw as the ruling party's failure to deliver on political freedoms. And the president, Gustavo Díaz Ordaz, who was the head of the PRI, simply was not having it. He was a classic Mexican authoritarian leader. And the students' uprising was in some ways a kind of personal insult to him, as well as a challenge to the ruling order.
There were reports at the time that armed snipers were up in surrounding buildings and shot towards the plaza, which then forced a military response. What do we know about what exactly happened there?
We know today much, much more than we knew, of course, in 1968, but even for decades afterwards, because initially the Mexican government was absolutely determined to hide and cover up what had happened. So there was a very aggressive stance on the part of Díaz Ordaz and the party that the students themselves had been firing from the building overlooking the square, that these radical leftist students with backing from Cuba and the Soviet Union wanted to take over the government and for that reason had taken arms into the Plaza of Tlatelolco. This simply wasn't true. It was a lie. And what actually happened, which we discovered slowly over the years, but more recently because of the opening of Mexican government archives, where we were finally for the first time, starting in 2002, able to look and read the secret history of what happened at Tlatelolco, we learned that, in fact, the president had placed snipers in those buildings that overlooked the square where 10,000 students and other people were gathered to protest, and that they had fired down into the crowd in order to create a kind of a chaos which would then permit the military to move in and arrest hundreds of people, which is, in fact, what happened.
You've also collected documents in order to do your research from the U.S. government, the CIA, the U.S. Embassy. Tell us about the U.S. government's involvement in Mexico at the time and our response to that massacre.
The United States was very close to Mexico in 1968. The CIA station chief, actually, Winston Scott, was a great friend, even a family friend, of Gustavo Díaz Ordaz, the president. Ordaz was at his wedding. Winscott was the godfather of Díaz Ordaz's child. And so that close relationship meant that these two men shared not only meals and drinks, but ideologies and a belief that communism was one of the great threats that the world faced, and that Mexico and the United States had to fight it together. The United States was supporting Mexico with money, with training for its military. And by the way, President Díaz Ordaz was in fact a paid asset of the Central Intelligence Agency. So the relationship was close on many, many levels. We fed them intelligence. They fed us intelligence. When the Tlatelolco massacre happened, it's quite clear that the CIA knew ahead of time that the Díaz Ordaz government was going to crack down. That's reflected in the declassified documents that we have today. And when the crackdown happened, the CIA and the U.S. Embassy at the time parroted the view that Díaz Ordaz promulgated, that it was the students who started the shooting and caused the violence that took place in the square, which again was simply a lie.
Early in September of this year, we saw major student demonstrations in Mexico City, and we interviewed a student organizer. His name is Naum Perez Monroy, and I want to play a clip from him.
On our behalf, the University Defense Committee, we are participating completely in the assemblies, and we are trying to uphold the historical memory. We are fighting so that this generation's education does not stop short, but rather that they recover the memories of so many other student struggles and social movements at the university and around the country.
I'm wondering, when you hear Naum talking and when you see, you know, students and young people getting very much political these days, do you think back to what happened 50 years ago? Are you seeing similarities there in between what happens in Mexico today versus 50 years ago?
Sure, but I don't think students are pouring into the streets because of what happened 5 decades ago. I think they're pouring into the streets because of violence and impunity from the government today. I think they're pouring into the streets because 4 years ago, almost to the day, 43 students were grabbed by police and drug traffickers in a tiny town in the state of Guerrero and disappeared and have never shown up. And the government has done nothing. So the students today, yes, there is a movement today. There is a pushback against the government. And in fact, the Mexicans just voted in a person to be president, López Obrador, who does not represent neither the ruling party nor even the sort of dominant opposition parties, but a new party that he has founded. So there is a kind of a resurgence, let's say, of hope for change and of demand for an end to the kind of heedless violence that has been going on in Mexico for much too long.
And last week, a commission from the Mexican government recognized the massacre as a state crime. In your opinion, you've done a ton of research on this. Is this sufficient? And is it a step towards justice?
No, it really isn't. The government commission that recognized that is a new and important commission that was set up by the current government of Peña Nieto to provide support and attention to victims of violence. That is not a government recognition of state responsibility for the crimes of Tlatelolco. Mexico is a long way away from fully embracing the state's role in killing young people on October 2nd, 1968. And right now, the government is even trying to censor and withdraw records that have been available in its archives for some years now about Tlatelolco. So Mexico has a long way to go before it is able to really face what happened on October 2nd, 1968.
Kate Doyle is a senior analyst with the National Security Archive and director of the Mexico Project there. Kate, thank you so much for your insights.
Thanks for the invitation, Tanzina.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, B-A-B-B-L-E.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
This next conversation is about consent and the consequences when consent is not given. And for those of you with young ones listening or those who might be upset by conversations around sexual assault, this material is explicit and could be triggering.
I remember when I was about 18 and there was this guy who was a friend of mine who I just thought was the most beautiful person in the world. And we had gone out one night, we'd been drinking a lot, and it wasn't until I turned around and saw him naked and he started taking my clothes off and pushing my head down that I realized that a really not a tiny part of me wanted to do that.
Isabel Jung is a correspondent for Vice on HBO. It was her own experience years ago that motivated her to make a new documentary film called Consent.
I remember saying to him, I don't really want to have sex. I also remember him kind of taking that as a cue to convince me.
But the film explores more than just the conversations required before a sexual interaction. In this current moment of Me Too and the emergence of decades-old sexual assault allegations in the public arena, Jung says we need to also be thinking about how to better deal with the trauma of the past. And what does that reckoning look like? In some cases, she says it looks like dialogue.
I think there's more awareness over it. I think that people are starting to talk about it. I mean, especially given what's happened over the last year, it's been almost a year since the Harvey Weinstein allegations came out. And there is a real trickle effect when that happens in Hollywood and in other parts of our society. And we start talking about what consent looks like for ourselves in our own daily lives, in our own sex lives and in dating.
What is consent? How is it being defined today? And has that definition evolved?
I was worried you were going to ask that question. I still don't know. It is essentially an agreement between normally two people as to whether we move forward with sex or not. But it is incredibly difficult to define, which is one of the things we found out in this piece. And how you get to the point of consent is constantly up for debate. One of the things that we explored in this piece was affirmative consent, you know, needing to have a solid yes before you move forward with any kind of sexual interaction. And that on the face of it is great because that would just dispel any kind of confusion around this topic. But when we actually think about it, you know, needing to have a yes when you stroke someone's hand, when you kiss someone, not always seen as very sexy. But maybe that's a problem with our society and our norms of what sexy and romance is. And maybe we need to start redefining that.
And then the question becomes, well, part of the question in this film is what can be gained by talking to the people who have hurt you? And I think that's a really delicate place to go, particularly given what we're learning recently about how long it takes, how these memories can be stored. I mean, does it help to confront the person or talk to them?
I think that it certainly depends on your own situation and how that trauma has manifested itself and how you feel about that particular scenario playing out. What we tracked in this documentary is a case of two adults who 10 years ago had sex. One person called that consensual sex a drunken incident. One person called that rape. And they sat down and had a face-to-face conversation.
I told myself it was a dream and that the things I thought I had seen and imagined just couldn't be real. Like really not wanting to face the next level of this line of questioning.
There's a lot that I don't remember how I got into your room, why I came into your room, when it happened, any of those details.
Witnessing that was incredibly powerful, very, very moving, raw conversation with a lot of vulnerability and a lot of humanity and forgiveness there as well.
It became the default was to believe you. And I became this source of problem in our community, this source of like a incongruity. No one could imagine you. I didn't want to see you like this. No one could imagine you like this. And it was easier to dismiss it. And so by default, everyone believed you. And you didn't have to do anything or change anything. And you got to keep everything the way it was. And I had to leave everything and leave everybody.
one of my biggest regrets throughout all of this is, in addition to, you know, hurting you that night and causing that trauma, I had 10 years of opportunities to write that. And I discarded you in this process.
It's interesting because at this time where we're talking about what accountability looks like, I mean, we really don't have a lot of options for how to handle situations that often happened years ago or even decades ago. And so this is one option to face it with conversation and dialogue.
Isn't there, I mean, I would also say it's a pretty dangerous way to approach it, depending on your situation. I mean, do you recommend trying to do that with a licensed professional, or is it something that you should just do on your own, call the person, or
No, certainly
not. Something that
not.
Brings up a lot of feelings.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And as I said, it's definitely not for everyone, and I wouldn't recommend doing it without seeking professional advice at all. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. It's a very controversial technique. It can cause re-traumatization. It can be seen as a too soft an approach for some people. I mean, some people do deserve to go through the criminal justice system. This is just an alternative option that I wasn't aware of before making this documentary and that we wanted to bring to the table as a possibility for some people.
Is there any other way that people should be thinking about getting to that level of reconciliation without a face-to-face meeting? And I think we often talk about forgiveness in a way that that's the end goal, but is it?
No, I mean, and in those restorative justice sessions, I should say that the end goal is not necessarily forgiveness. The restorative justice sessions allow the survivor to be in the driver's seat. And so it's up to them whether they forgive or not, or whether they want more sessions, or whether they want to continue that conversation, or whether they want to just let it go. There are obviously many different ways in which individuals find healing and find closure. And this is definitely not a be-all and end-all solution for everyone. I would say that there are limited options because, you know, as we all know, the criminal justice system is often fails us in when we want to handle these situations. And 6 out of 1,000 cases of sexual assault go without convictions. And so we have very limited options, but this is just one of the ones that we tried to showcase here.
And at the beginning of the film, you mentioned your own experience that you said falls into the sort of gray area of consent. Did that experience make you change the way you think about trauma?
I think that it's an interesting time to talk about trauma. If the last few days have shown us anything, it is that trauma is real and lasting and can run extremely deep. I've been surprised over the last year or so that that experience has had a lasting impact and that I do find myself thinking back to that very uncomfortable moment that I thought I'd left behind a long time ago.
Isabel Jung is a correspondent for Vice on HBO. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Since last week, we've been hearing stories of transitioning to life after prison on The Takeaway. Today, we'll speak to one specific group about that experience, older people, those who have spent decades and often the majority of their lives in prison. So what happens when they get out?
They face huge challenges.
Stanley Richards is the executive vice president of the New York City-based Fortune Society, which provides housing and counseling for those returning from incarceration.
All of the resources for a supportive housing program, which many of these folks would need, people who are coming out older, who served longer times, are not eligible for those services. Why? Because the federal government said people who serve more than 90 days in an institution is, one, not considered homelessness, so they don't have the homeless status. Two, most of the resources in the city and the state are targeting chronically homeless people, which means people who have been living in the shelter for 12 months to 2 years. These are folks who are coming home who don't have any family, not able to get a job. They're older. Where do they go? What resources do they have?
Takeaway producer Alexandra Botee visited the Fortune Society to speak to a group of older men reentering normal life after decades behind bars.
Yes, my name is Lee Crawford. I did 12. I've been out for 2 years now. I'm 60 years old.
My name is Norman Latham. I did 44 years. I'm 74.
I'm Carl Dukes. I'm 74. I did 31 years in upstate.
My name is Larry White. I spent this last time 32 years in prison.
So the ones 53 years, 10 months. I'm 72.
My name is William Hicks. I just came home exactly 1 month ago, and I did 25 years in prison.
My name is Nurdin Kabir. I did 42 years, 3 months, which comes out to 507. Came home 2016 in June on my birthday. And I lived this long to see 77 years old. I don't feel like it.
That is a familiar refrain for many of these men. None of them say they feel their age.
I call myself, I say, we are demolition men, like Wesley Snipes, because we got sentenced to a time warp. In my mind, I'm 33 years old, but on paper, I'm 77.
I'm still 33.
Because your age don't change, because you didn't get a chance to watch it.
Yes, right.
So when you went in jail at a certain age, you come out, you the same age, but a different number. In 3 years, I'd be 80 years old. 80. I don't know what it feels like to be 80.
But these men's bodies tell a different story. Most have medical issues impacting their day-to-day lives, and those struggles might be different if the men had been given better medical care in prison. For Norman Latham, a drop foot made it hard for him to walk when he was behind bars.
I honestly believe that a lot of us did get out on our merits. I'm not talking about the young guys, I'm talking about the old guys. I think we got out of jail because of our medical condition and the financial problems that we were causing for the correctional system. You know, I mean, it takes a lot of money for you to transfer me, put me on a bus, and to take me to another facility for them to just look at me and send me back to that facility. When I was in Otisville, I went to downstate to see a doctor about my dropped foot. What he did is that he clipped my toenails, and he says, okay, I'm finished. So I asked him, I didn't come over here to get my toenails clipped. I could have did that back at the unit. The police is laughing because he know, oh, this guy ain't even looked at none. All he did was clip. We brought him over here just to get his toenails clipped.
Lee Crawford's story is similar. He was in prison when his eyes began to fail him.
I didn't know what it was, of course. I started stumbling and started, like, I couldn't see, like, everything was getting, like, real cloudy. So they rushed me to emergency. It went back and forth. Oh, nothing wrong with you. You're all right. Which is hard to get contacts in jail. So they started giving me contact, but they never told me about the condition I had. I didn't find this out until I came home. So this was, like, maybe 18 months prior to me coming home. Like, my eyes was getting worse and worse and worse. I would notice it was, like, a lot of gray.
They never told you that you had macular degeneration?
No. I didn't find out until he came out on the street. He never gave me no medication, no nothing. They just said, oh, it stopped straining your body or whatever silliness they would come up with. Or they would write me up.
Life after prison is not just marked by physical challenges for these men. They've also had to adapt to day-to-day tasks that most people take for granted.
When I took my first bath, I felt like a coward. When I sat down, I felt vulnerable, like somebody's going to run in on me. Because, you know, you're used to standing up, watching your back, and you know what I'm saying? When you sit down and relax, and I wasn't used to that at all. It felt so strange taking a bath. It felt strange.
Stairs, you don't have stairs in mediums. And I've been to quite a few stairs. That's good. That's good. It's strange, but it's life, though.
I've been to Coney Island 4 times, and I wouldn't even try to go there because the trains is different. You get lost.
I went down to 59th Street during rush hour, not intentionally, but I found myself I had to actually stop and get against the building. I felt, you know, paranoid. I felt uneasy, especially being around people. Most prisons where we come from, looking at a woman is reckless eyeballing. So to be in a close proximity of them is like you find yourself overreacting to move away from them. It's little things like that.
Something not so little, how the men said their relationships with their families, especially their children, have changed since their release.
My 27-year-old is now the parent. Since I've been away and I've been gone, she has this situation where she feels like I tell you what to do now instead of you telling me as a father what to do. And being away for so long, you kind of lose the privileges of being that person who's the discipliner or the person who they need to respect.
For some of these men, including Nurdin Kabir, any version of life on the outside is better than being locked up until the end, especially if they never expected to make it to freedom.
I'm so fortunate to be here this time in space on the planet because I know when they sentenced me, they didn't think I was going to make it. And I look back and a lot of the people who started out with me, a lot of them didn't make it. A lot of them. We've seen a lot of them fall by the wayside.
They died in prison?
They died by prison drugs, HIV, drug overdoses, beefs in the yard, stabbings and all that. We are rare. We survived.
With that survival, says Carl Dukes, comes a mission.
When you go to the parole board and you get hit, they always send you a piece of paper that says, we believe that if released at this time, you will not live and abide by the law mm-hmm. without committing a crime. Mm-hmm. And my thing is, every day, that's all I want to do is prove him wrong and to prove to you that I desire to be a part of society again.
And along the way, there are even some moments of joy.
Why not take all of me? Can't you see? I'm no good without you. Take these lips. I want to lose them. Take these arms. I'll never use them.
You're that was Carl Dukes, Lee Crawford, Larry White, Nelson Rivera, Norman Latham, William Hicks, Joseph Luntz, and Nurdin Kabir. Takeaway producer Alexandra Botee spoke with them at the Fortune Society here in New York.
That once was my heart, so why not take all of me?
That story was part of our coverage chronicling people's experiences after getting out of prison. You can find all the stories at thetakeaway.org/afterprison. And that's our show for today. Remember, you can always get with us on our Facebook page, our Instagram page, or Twitter at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
The Takeaway is supported by Timeshare Exit Team, founded on the belief that valid contracts must have a reasonable term. Exit options at timeshareexitteam.com.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.